And the
podcast
begins with a song of rebellion.
How can this
podcast
be my life?
CD Burners.
Right now, I'm outside of your window with my radio.
Do you think that's how he actually recorded? Whisper screaming?
No, well, here's the thing. I watched a bunch of videos of them on late night shows.
Yeah.
Which is wild. That was like a wild thing
for me
to see. Like them on... And the thing is, like the fucking audience, it was like Jimmy Kimmel, like they like knew it. They were really like, I don't know if they, you know, if when they do those things, they put out a thing that's like, if you're fans of Hawthorne Heights, come to this thing. Mm-hmm. But like, it was...
Was it a bunch of emo kids? Just like
it didn't show, not really, like it didn't really show mm-hmm. like who it was, but you could actually hear them singing with them, which was fucking cool. Like I was
it in the normal Jimmy Kimmel studio?
I think it was outside.
Yeah, because like Jimmy Kimmel, he would... do like different concert, like almost like concerts, and it would be for the fans.
Yeah, I mean, well, they did one, and it's like, look.
Well, first of all, guys, welcome to CD Burners.
Welcome to CD Burners. We're talking about Hawthorne Heights.
The Silence in Black and White.
The Silence in Black and White album.
It came out June 1st, 2004 on Victory Records.
I'm going to stop you right there.
Okay.
I think an important thing to remember and to like really view this record with the eyes of it being very 2004.
Yes.
And I want to paint a picture about what 2004 looked like.
Okay.
So things that happened in 2004, like Facebook launched, but for Harvard only.
Mm-hmm.
The Incredibles came out and World of Warcraft came out. The thing is, the thing about 2004, the popularity of emo and pop punk were like at, it's a pivotal album.
It was building.
It was fucking like my Three Cheers for Sweet Revenge came out.
Yeah.
American Idiot came out. Warped Tour was like at its peak. This Warped Tour was at its peak in 2004.
Totally.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was. I just want, I'm just painting a picture of what the world looked like then. And then we can want to talk about the album and like the significance of why we're painting this picture. TRL was still like very much popping.
Mm-hmm.
Here's where like the image that I want to get into people's minds. This was like quintessential when you think of emo and all of the shit that it gets online and all of the tropes that we see with it. This was that year.
This is, I think what you're trying to say is like this album is, I think it has become the stereotype people think of when they say emo.
It's that to me. You nailed it. That's exactly why the significance of this album. It was the time and a place and people. It was the right time, place, people, and in the scene. This was like very mall punk culture, like mall punk culture. I mean, I did it. I hung out at the mall, and like this was when we talk about like mall fashion and mall culture at this time in 2004. You got to remember, it was skinny jeans. It was swoopy hair. It was studded belt buckles.
I was that. And
I was that too.
I loved this album in high school. I loved it. Like this Hawthorne Heights album was like the blueprint for my screamo band that me and my 15-year-old friends had. Like we loved it.
This is that, which is exactly what it should have been. Like that's right. What you just said is the reason why it is so important.
Listening to it now in 2024, I don't connect with the album the same way that I did back in 2004. I am also 34 and not 14. But I don't know. I think that what you're saying is like it was very of the moment. This album was extremely 2004. I think it did define a word, a subculture, a trend for a moment. I don't know the lasting legacy of this album, but I can see how important it is for the scene and the trajectory that it was on at the time.
I can tell you the lasting legacy of this album. The lasting legacy of this album is when your parents think emo.
Mm-hmm.
They don't think Get Up Kids. They don't think Saves the Day. They don't think Dashboard Confessional. They think this album. They think Hawthorne Heights.
Yeah.
This is the album that, like, if you're playing and your parents come in, they go, "The fuck are you listening to?
Yeah.
Oh, god damn it, dude. My kid is doing this.
Yeah.
You're fucking wearing eyeliner. You're fucking straight ironing your hair. You're like, this is that album. This is the god damn it, dude. My fucking kid is listening. My kid's an emo."
Mm-hmm.
And that is what that did was made. Even though the bands that I just named don't sound like this band, this album made all of those bands get lumped into one specific thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so for people not in the know. So the significance of this album was that if it kind of mushed everything together from what people viewed emo as if they were on the outside in 2004.
Right.
Now, whether that's good or bad, I in my opinion, I don't think that it's good to generalize anything. Everything is different. But it is the way it is. It is the way of the world. You can't just say it's not. Now, the lasting power, we get all these like emo meme pages. We get like Catatonic Youths. We get all of this shit that people are like, that don't know about emo. And it sounds like this album.
Yeah.
That is the lasting power of what this album did.
Well, this came out on Victory Records. This was Hawthorne Heights' first release under the name Hawthorne Heights. They actually had a different name. A Day in the Life was their original name.
A Day to Remember in the Life.
And then they got signed to Victory Records. And
I want to talk about this in that moment, too. They sent out physical demos, which were called press kits.
Yes.
Now, if you guys were around that time and you're in this scene, you know what those look like. It's like basically a one sheet of like Weir Band. It's like a shows everything and it's physical and you hand it to people. Now they're called EPKs. They're electronic press kits. So this was before EPKs. I want to really set the tone for this fucking album and having them go out and hand out press kits to labels and to people and to get signed from it, impressive and telling.
I think they're a hardworking band. I think they always have been. I think they still are extremely hardworking. You know, look at their Is for Lovers Festival. They're still out there hustling, and they were out there before they were even Hawthorne Heights, hawking their demos. It ends up at Victory Records. Victory Records calls them up, has them play for them. Then they get signed, become Hawthorne Heights. They record this album in a period of 4 weeks.
Do you know where?
You tell me.
I believe it was Wisconsin.
Madison, Wisconsin.
It was Madison, Wisconsin.
And it was at Butch Vig's studio.
So, which Butch Vig is can you rattle off some of the fucking things that he's produced? Because it's absolutely incredible.
Butch Vig, let's see. He's most famous.
Like Garbage.
We know him from Garbage. He's in Garbage. He plays drums in Garbage, I want to say. He does play drums in Garbage. But he produced all these albums, Nirvana, Smashing Pumpkins, Sonic Youth. His studio in Wisconsin is an iconic place. It's called Smart Studios. And the Hawthorne Heights guys were super excited to be up there in Wisconsin. They stayed, I think, at a Red Roof Inn down the street in Madison for 4 weeks and busted out this album at the Legendary Studios. One weird thing, though, I actually got the physical CD, too. There's no producer credit. And I do want to ask JT about this, because there's no producer listed on the album.
I feel like that's a person who you really are like, yes, this guy fucking produced my album.
But yeah, like Butch wasn't involved, but they did it at his studio.
Oh, okay, all right.
I did find some rumors that it was produced by Sean O'Keefe, who has worked with Fall Out Boy, Motion City Soundtrack, The Hush Sound, Less Than Jake. It is listed on his Wikipedia that he did produce this. But I have the physical CD, and it does not say Sean O'Keefe produced the album.
It doesn't say anybody produced it?
It doesn't.
Well, we're going to uncover a mystery for you guys on why that is when we talk to JT. So if you listen to the fucking album, man, it's like it embodies what it's like to be a teenager, an alternative teenager in Wisconsin in 2004.
Yeah, and they're from Ohio, obviously.
Like, it embodies that.
It's Midwest.
Midwest. Teen. It embodies that like Midwest loneliness. Like, I think it embodies that like Midwest emptiness. And I'm not saying this is Midwest emo. I'm saying this is an emo band from the Midwest. So I'm not saying that, you motherfuckers.
The album is really bleak. Like, there's a lot of space. You know, the guitars, they don't clash with each other. Like, it's not like a lot of sound all on top of each other all the time. It's like the guitars, the vocals, everything's like really spaced out and airy and like desolate. And I think that that's intentional.
Look, you know, talking about this album, talking about the time, talking about how it sounds, you know, this was an album that was true to that band. This album was a true to that band album. Like, whether I love it or not, it is what it set out to be. And it really shaped the way that, like, I think people outside of this scene viewed what this scene was. So there, it's like, in there lies the importance of this. But it did, when they were doing this, like, he knew that his lyrics were going to get torn apart. Like, he already knew. Like, he knew that his lyrics were going to get torn apart when he was doing this. You know, while listening to it now, we know a ton of other bands that sound similar, but at the time, the sort of style was a lot of ways pioneering the next generation of bands. You know, that's why I say that this album belongs in a time capsule of 2004. Like, this is if I had to pick, and that's the thing. If I had to pick one album from 2004, this would be it. Because nothing feels like 2004 more than this album.
That is so true.
It said they didn't have a budget, and I said in parentheses, it sounds like they didn't have a budget.
Okay.
And said because they didn't have a budget, they acted like a fucking band and not a bunch of divas. Which, yeah. Which is like very cool to me. That's a cool thing. And like staying at the Red Roof Inn, and they weren't planning on making it like overnight. They tore it out of vans. They wrote songs. They sent letters. And so, you know, like they did as emo as it gets. Like as emo as it gets.
I think we really should ask JT about what it was like at this time for them. You know, I think because they hadn't put anything out as Hawthorne Heights, and they had a record deal, it was probably a very exciting time for them.
Well, I have a couple quotes from him.
Okay.
I remember a lot of late nights laughing, a lot of long days recording, sleeping on the floors in lumpy beds at the Red Roof Inn in Madison. I remember thinking about all the great sounds that have come out of smart studios from bands that we had adored and used those positive vibes to be able to get through a few hard days. You know, a lot of the lyrics were inspired by feeling by yourself. Everyone feels isolated to a degree because we all have to live inside our own minds. Whether we're locked in a small town, struggling in a big city, trapped in a dead-end job, or raised in a harmful environment, we all have to deal with isolation. To me, that is where I was coming from with the lyrics of silence. You have to struggle and work hard to find out who you are in life. These lyrics were part of my struggle. I was also able to adapt situations and other people going through some of these stories found on silence. Knowing that, listening to the album, I can be like, yes, that sounds like that. Like, this sounds exactly what you're talking about. To me, it sounded like a beginner band starting, being excited at a Red Roof Inn, fucking around, getting drunk, and being so excited to go into a studio where, like, legends have performed and legends have put out albums. Like, this is like what every young band dreams of doing.
Well, then they make this record, and then Victory Records comes in and blows them up. You know, I think it was very of the moment. I don't think Hawthorne Heights would have been as big without the Victory marketing machine pushing them fucking everywhere.
Didn't they have a fucking thing?
Yes. Victory screwed everybody over.
That's such a bitch. What's that guy doing now?
He sold Victory Records a few years ago for $30 million.
So he's just chilling.
Yeah, he's probably chilling.
I wonder if he'd talk to us.
Doubt it.
Dude, I'd love to talk to him and be like, why are you such a motherfuck?
Tony Brummel.
In addition to some of the things that JT said before about recording this album, he also said, there are a few songs that I think that we could have finished a little bit better. No shame, I agree. I would make a few things faster to add a little bit of energy. Otherwise, this is what I thought was beautiful about it. This is this quote, right? Is otherwise, why change the past if you're proud of it? I like to think that we would do a better job now because of what we've all been through, but there's something about the energy of being there for the first time. That's what this album sounds like.
Yeah, it does. I think this album, like we talked about, has become a stereotypical screamo emo album. And I think that it doesn't get more cliche than the lyrics of Ohio is for Lovers. Cut my wrists and black my eyes. That defines the stereotype of emo.
And the thing about it is they were serious.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. It's like, yeah, they were serious, sure, about those lyrics. And yeah, I think that with that earnesty of them saying that, like, I don't know if you saw on TikTok today or like whatever, there's like some kid who just like dressed normal, like dressed like some hardcore kid, and keeps getting roasted. But he was like earnest. He was like earnest about it. And like, so he got roasted for like 4 days. Now everybody's coming out and being like, dude, he's just like being himself. Like, shut the fuck up. And so, like, which I agree with. Like, yeah, he was a little goofy on the internet, but like, who gives a shit? He seems like a nice guy. But everybody's like roasting him. And it's a really strange like turn of events to see people roasting and then being like defending it. But what I'm saying is that these lyrics, this album was earnest in what it was. And, you know, it did get roasted. It got roasted by fucking my parents. It got roasted by like my friends that didn't listen to this stuff. It got roasted by like, you know, this sounded different. This sounded different. These are screams on this album that like people who never heard harder songs, they would think they wouldn't understand these screams.
Yeah, I kept wanting this album to go harder. It never fully goes into a breakdown. Like, the songs are so melancholy, and then you just have like, like in the background. And I kept waiting for like the mosh moment, and it never goes there.
Yeah, the album edges you. Like, yeah. Like the album like legitimately edges you. And also, like, look, that might be the point to this album. That, you know, you have that bleakness. You like have something that like you never get, you never want, you know, you always are looking for, but you don't get. And they did that with this album. I don't know whether that was intentional, but it is the truth about the album. You know, like, there are things that I really, really love about it. You know, they do the like chug chug and then like twinkle guitar stuff. Like, it's like chug chug twinkle guitar verse. Shit, I love. They did a lot of that on this album, and I really, you know, that influenced a lot of like how I wrote songs, and what I think is good about songs. I like that stuff that stuck with me, you know. But I gotta say, like, you know, my fucking parents would be like, "God damn it, dude, what the fuck?
Yeah,
are you doing?
Yeah,
you know."
Well, I'm gonna run through some fast facts real quick about this album. We'll start with the chart data. Number 56 on the Billboard 200, number 1 on Heat Seekers, number 4 on the top independent albums. It is certified gold. At the end of the year 2005, it was number 141 on the Billboard 200. There are multiple songs named or based off of films that the members liked. Silver Bullet is named after the movie Silver Bullet. Nikki FM includes a reference to the film Say Anything. He's outside of her window with the radio. And JT talks about how much he just loves films and how films convey messages better than words do. At the time, this was the most successful and best-selling debut in Victory Records history. And the song The Transition was the first song written for the album, while Ohio Is for Lovers wasn't written until they were in the studio.
Yeah, didn't they write that song in like...
Probably.
Like, right, like, yeah, a couple, like a
few minutes.
Yeah. Usually it's kind of what happens, you know, yeah. Like they sing something in your head and then you like got to go and you're in the studio and you like got to do it.
Yeah,
I don't know, dude. It's just like it really sets the tone, like going from the Red Roof Inn to the fucking this iconic studio and the sounds like I really, you know, it brought like if anything, listening to this album brought back a lot of memories for me. And so like therefore it is important. Like, if you listen to this album and it brings back memories about what you were doing, it's important. Audibly, like, I'm not the hugest fan of it all the way through. I think that it's got some incredibly redeeming and iconic parts, and I think that it shaped a lot of bands that came after them. This is like, dude, I bet, like, fucking, there were so many bummed girlfriends. Like, listen to that, like, your girlfriend's so bummed when your, like, boyfriend is going to the you go to the show with your boyfriend and he's doing the screaming parts next to you. I bet fucking there's so many.
Yeah, that was me, probably.
Yeah, I bet there's so many bummed girlfriends. The review said that Hawthorne Heights offered absolutely nothing new, that those acts did not already do, but what they did do pretty well. Most of the songs have reasonably catchy choruses. There was no particular egregious mistakes or failed experiments. Punknews.org staff member Brian Schultz wrote that the band suffers in how much they water down the tempo and praying that they do something to differentiate themselves. Alternative Press ranked Ohio is for Lovers at number 88 of the best 100 singles from the 2000s. Look, you got to also, like, remember, like, the social and, like, the cultural aspects of the time, right? Like, it was, like, a very DIY ethos, you know? Like, despite its commercial success, the scene retained a DIY ethos. You know, many of the bands, like, starting on independent labels and starting zines, like, this was that time. Promoting shows and engaging in, like, look, online... What I know, I was like, that's them really playing funny. Jimmy Kimmel, because I just put it on my notes to watch.
That is so funny.
But this was a big deal in online times. Like, this, like, I was shocked that this hasn't come up actually before. We were talking about how 2004 this motherfucker was like, websites like MySpace and Pure Volume became essential for bands to share their music and connect with fans. Obviously, these fans use their platforms to express their personal identities, discover new music, and build communities, right? This was a big MySpace time. In conclusion, I think I have a conclusion here. Mm-hmm. I also have my opinions, but 2004 was a watershed moment for a lot of alternative mall teen punk culture, significantly shaping music, fashion, and teen attitudes. The influence of this era is still felt today, with many bands experiencing resurgence in popularity, anniversary tours for their classic albums, and a lasting impact on fashion trends. The scene also laid the groundwork for the next generation of alternative music by fostering a community that valued emotional expression, authenticity, and a break from mainstream norms.
Did you write that?
I did.
Did ChatGPT write that?
No, I wrote that.
You're a smart guy. What are you talking about? You always say you're dumb. That's really smart.
No, I was like, I did a lot of that. I did. Look, man, it's because I couldn't get out of, like, the 2004 thing with this album.
Yeah.
I was like, in 2004, I was smoking. Okay, so listen, in 2004, I lived at my friend Justin Harris's house in Oro Valley in Tucson.
How old are you? You were born
20.
In 1984.
Yeah, I was 20.
20.
So I had a room in my friend Justin Harris's house, who had a really nice house. He had a really nice house in Oro Valley. I had a room in it. In my room, there was a mattress, but the mattress wasn't on the fucking floor. It was leaned against the wall. And so I would smoke crack and go to sleep under the mattress that was, like, shaped like a teepee. And that was the only thing that was in my room. That was it. And that is the time when I would listen to the Hawthorne Heights. Like, so it reminds me of that. And then what would I do? I would go to shows.
What, did you just not have blankets? That was your blanket?
Dude, when you smoke crack all the time, like, nothing makes sense. Like, I just had a mattress and I was like, that's fine. And I slept under it on the floor and the mattress was like this. So, like, that is where I was in 2004.
God.
So, I mean, the thing is like, what I said is, like, it really threw me back into that time and that feeling of, like,
being under a mattress,
smoking crack, but then, like, going to a punk show at this fucking venue called Scrappy's in Tucson, and, like, remembering, like, what it's like, all of this. The music reminded me of, like, smells, which is, like, the most nostalgic thing. Like, I remembered what it was like to be in that venue. I remember what it was like to be out late at night in the summer in Tucson with my friends. It smelled like oranges and gardenias, and you're just drinking and listening to this. Mm. Listening to this album like fucked me up.
Yeah, I mean, it threw me back to being like 16 and sneaking out of fucking my friend's house and going to see girls and like staying out and telling your parents you were sleeping at one place and you were sleeping at somewhere else. And yeah, like now that you're saying it too, like I absolutely was thrown back to like the Lo-Fi Cafe in Salt Lake City where I used to go see bands all the fucking time. I could smell that place and like feel what it was like to be there. Feel my fucking skinny jeans.
It's really, really, really interesting. And I think for me, this album does something that like the other albums we've reviewed haven't done for me, which is like very much set a tone and very much set like a time in my life where it probably was one of the worst, but also at the same time, it was probably one of the best. You know, it's like it just is the way that it went. And that I think that this album probably does that for a lot of other people.
Morgan, what were your standout tracks on this record?
I like Nikki FM, dude.
Yeah?
Yeah, I like Nikki FM. I think that does a good job of like, if you know, I when you say standout tracks when we do this, I'm like, what is one song that I could like show somebody to be like, here's like the fucking album you're gonna get when you listen to this song, and like Nikki FM is that song for me.
For sure. Nikki FM is a great song. Ohio is for Lovers, classic, iconic riff to open it up.
How many plays does that have right
Ohio
now?
Is for Lovers has 111,299,918.
Like, that says something, man.
Nikki FM has 25 million.
Yeah, I mean, that says something. Like, 100 million plays is a lot of motherfucking plays for a band like this.
Yep.
That says something. It says, like, you know, they lasted the test of time. They lasted, like, you know, and I don't know if they set out to be what I view them as. And I'm going to be really interested to talk to JT and hear his opinion on what he thinks about that time, that place, and what they set out to do, and if this album did that for them.
Well, I think this album solidified them as a pillar of the scene for sure. And, you know, like we've said a few times, when you say emo, people say Hawthorne Heights. Like, they're a name. Like, they defined sort of this third wave of emo, whatever the people say it is. But they defined sort of this next generation of, like, screamo emo music. Like, you can't say screamo without saying Hawthorne Heights.
You know, they also did, like, I think they were, like, around the time of where everybody was, like, naming their bands after places, like Evergreen Terrace and Hawthorne Heights and shit like that. It was, like, very distinct moment in time. And a lot of those bands didn't go on to do, like, bigger things, but Hawthorne Heights made it out of the trenches and they fucking, like, went on to do shit. And I think there was something distinct about this album. There was something very, very unique and eerie. And look, I don't think that there's a better album for me that defines that era. And I think that that's like my biggest takeaway from this full album. And so when they play this and When We Were Young, I wonder when they do play those songs, like the B-sides off of these albums, if those kids are going to get like fucking transformed back into like what it was like. Because there are some songs that don't do that. There are some songs that, you know, that don't do that for people. They're great songs, but they don't do what this album in particular did to me.
Do you have anything? If you like this, you might like that.
Motherfucker, I do.
What did you say?
So, while I was smoking crack in Tucson, there was another band called Versus the Mirror. And Versus the Mirror was playing locally around Tucson. They'd go on like these small tours. They were kind of like the Bled Light, but really great guys in that band. Really, really great guys in that band. I stay in touch with those guys a bunch. But there's some really solid songs that they put out. They're called Versus the Mirror. I do not believe that they are a band anymore. They might have done a reunion thing recently, but they were like, I think they got picked up by some label.
It says they were on Equal Vision.
They're on Equal Vision.
And they lasted from 2003 to 2007.
Yep. So
founded in Tucson. I wrote down Silverstein, which is not groundbreaking to anybody. Like, if you've listened to Hawthorne Heights, you listen to Silverstein. And I think when this album came out, they just kept getting compared to Silverstein. But for me, when I was listening to these, to Hawthorne Heights in 2004, I was also bumping Silverstein super loud in my 1992 Jeep Cherokee.
We might have had the same car.
We did. Yeah.
Did we talk about that?
We've talked about it in the past, yeah.
God damn, I didn't remember that. Well, yeah. I hope you guys enjoyed a deep dive down memory lane for this album.
We have JT waiting for us in the wings, ready to do a little interview. We got a few questions for him about this seminal album from Hawthorne Heights. Right. We'll be back next week, but stay tuned for this interview with JT Woodruff of Hawthorne Heights.
Wait a second.
Now you have to do your ad reads.
Yeah. Okay. Are you going to like cut and put these in, or yeah, are we just going to go right off the cuff right here? Might be kind of funny to just do this.
No, I think we got to put it in. Maybe, yeah.
BetterHelp. If you're going through, and that's not BetterHelp.
I wish. BetterHelp, yeah. If you want to sponsor the pod and help people who might be listening to Hawthorne Heights.
Fucking for real, BetterHelp. If you listen to Hawthorne Heights in 2004, you should have a BetterHelp subscription. Like that, there, yeah, I did it for you. All right, and this is the real one. In Say Anything episode.
No, that's just the direction in the Say Anything episode.
Okay.
So you can, there's three options there.
Okay. I'm about to blow your freaking mind, motherfucker. Did you know it's the 20th anniversary of Say Anything's Is a Real Boy? We're old as fuck. Not only that, but Emo Night is presenting a 20th anniversary tour for the album. What timeline are we living in, even? Tickets are going so fast, so grab yours now at sayanythingmusic.net. You fucks.
All right, guys. JT, welcome to CD Burners. Thanks for being here with us.
Of course. Thank you guys for having me. Thanks for including us. And I love the entire vibe of what you guys are doing. So thanks for always, you know, curating the scene and being tastemakers and just being good dudes.
Thanks. Appreciate that. I think we told you a little bit about the podcast, but yeah, we took a deep dive into The Silence in Black and White, such a pivotal album for the scene, such a pivotal moment. 2004 was a huge year, and you guys were kind of at the forefront of everything, especially with this album. So we just wanted to dive in with you and try to give people a little bit more color about the time that you guys spent making this record. I think the stuff that we're trying to get into on this podcast is stuff that people can't necessarily Google. We're looking for like fun anecdotes, maybe little stories, any sort of like behind the scenes stuff, maybe things that people haven't heard about the album. So Silence in Black and White, I believe, was your first album as Hawthorne Heights. You guys were previously a band called A Day in the Life. I read a lot about how you guys were hustling back then to try and get signed. You were out there sending demos, playing shows, putting together press kits, and getting the music in front of people, which then landed you a spot on Victory Records. Can you tell us a little bit about the hustle and grind before you became Hawthorne Heights to get to that point?
Yeah, absolutely. it's been a long, long road and a long, long ride. But, you know, the funny thing is, you know, I'm just a guy from West Virginia that moved to Dayton, Ohio to try to start a band to get a record deal, which is hilarious because one would normally move to maybe LA or New York or something like that. And for some reason, Dayton, Ohio was a conduit that I needed for success. But really, it just comes down to finding the right group of guys. So you mentioned, you know, we were in a band called A Day in the Life. And, you know, I was probably 2 or 3 years older than those members. So there was a little bit of like filtering in and out. And I was always just a little bit more serious than those guys. You know, they were kind of just graduated high school and they were more into playing, you know, like local shows and being in a garage band and stuff like that. And I was already ready to like hit the road and like try to do it for real. And it had become my true passion. So it took me a little bit of time to move here and then filter in a couple of guys out in and out until I found the right group of people, because I wasn't from here. So, you know, I didn't know anybody. These weren't like high school friends or anything like that. So you just play shows at a local Knights of Columbus rental hall and you just meet friends that'll change your life. And that's kind of how life was back then. And, you know, so we eventually find the right group of guys and we all start playing together and it's feeling good. You know, previously we were more of like a pop punk band. I've always had kind of a high voice. So I've always kind of sounded somewhere in between, you know, Saves the Day and Newfound Glory and stuff like that. So that was, and Blink 182. So that was kind of the scene that I grew up in. And then once we started to kind of get into heavier stuff, you know, like hardcore and stuff like that, we wanted to kind of throw in some screaming. And like, I always try to kind of let the fans know, obviously you guys know, but like that stuff really wasn't happening back then. There wasn't like a blueprint yet for like kind of singing and screaming. There were a couple of bands that were doing it. You know, you kind of, the Used kind of popped out and like everybody was loving them, including us. And then you have like, you know, like Thursday was kind of on the artier side of that. You know, they trended more into the hardcore scene and stuff like that. Yeah, Taking Back Sunday, which is like a totally different beast. They're not singing or screaming. They're doing everything all rolled into one. And the swagger of Adam's vocals are just out of this world. So they're not really kind of doing it either. But, you know, everything's kind of all rolled into one. So we were just trying to find our way with having, like, we've always been a band that sings more than we scream, which you would notice way more now. But back then we sounded like, you know, Slayer. Basically, yeah. Because nobody was really doing it. So, but yeah, we were just trying to find, but our only rule when writing those first group of songs were we wanted to write songs that we felt would change our lives, because if they could change our lives, we feel like they could change somebody else's life. And, you know, we never dreamed that they actually would or anything, but we just wanted to take time and take care. We've always kind of done shows ourselves and stuff like that. I think that's where like the DIY attitude comes from. Like we're from a town that has no music venues. So you just had to put up your own money, rent shows and stuff like that. So I think that's where that constant hustle in our lives come from. Also, we're from a town where nothing happens. It's all, you know, blue collar Midwest. So it all felt really normal to us. Like I have no idea how a band would do it now, because it seems like you can just put songs out and that's either hopeful or hopeless. You know, back then, like we could, if we hit the ground running, we could see our progress. And if, as long as we kept working, we would get more progress. So, you know, I remember the first day that, you know, we started to send our demos out, and I remember rejection letters, and I remember like the false hope of maybe this label's interested. And you know, it was such a wild time. Like I remember the first time that we actually got a showcase, we were all at Guitar Center hanging out, getting ready to go to band practice. This is probably the first time I've ever told this part of this story, but like our drummer, Aaron was working for Time Warner Cable. So he had just had like a corporate job. He had a college degree from the University of Dayton, which is a very expensive, respected university. And he wanted to be in a band. And we were like, Mac, making fun of him entirely. We're like, dude, you're literally living the dream right now. And you're trying to throw away the dream in hopes that, you know, this happens. And obviously I'm the idiot because it happened, but yeah. So he calls us and we're on our way to lunch and we're going to Fuddruckers. which is embarrassing, by the way.
No,
totally embarrassing in the best way.
No, that is awesome. That's a good place to go. I'm going to get
married. Yeah, so we leave Guitar Center and go there, and you know, he calls us. He's like, "All right, I need everybody on the phone right now." And you know, we're talking Nokia brick phones. We're not mm-hmm. talking about, I don't even think there's a speakerphone function, yeah. But we're all like huddled around it, and it's like, "All right, Victory Records wants to sign us." And he's always kind of a bit of a bullshitter that like sees the positive in everything. And I'm more of a realist. I'm like, tell me exactly what they're saying. Because when you say Victory Records wants to sign us, that means there's a contract in the inbox. And he's like, well, he's asking if we could come for a showcase. I'm like, that doesn't mean he wants to sign us. That means that he's interested and we got to go, you know, hit a home run here. Or he doesn't want to sign us. So, you know, it's not looking on the dark side of things,
sure.
But like always being ultra cautious. Good news is never quite good news until you realize, you know, what could be if you drop the ball. But
that reminds me of a very interesting, that reminds me of a specific relationship that we've got going on right now.
We'll have to talk off camera about that. But yeah, you know, like it's absolutely wild. So like
where was this showcase? I read that, you know, you had to do this showcase, I think for Tony. You guys are in Dayton, Ohio. Did you have to travel somewhere? Did he come to you? Where was this? Paint a picture for us.
So it was in the winter. I remember it was the coldest time in the world. And we had to drive up to Chicago. And, you know, like we're small town kids. Like Chicago is, we've never been
big
there.
City.
We've never done anything like that. Yeah. So like we're also dealing with the element of holy shit. We're Like back then, I don't know if anxiety existed, but I know it does now. So we're just like operating on raw energy and like being freaked out and loving every minute of it. So about 2 days before we're going to go up for this showcase, and my rule is, as the cautious one, I was like, do not tell anybody that we're doing this. Nobody. Because the last thing you want to do is tell somebody you're going to do something and fail. So we're playing this very close to our chest, and my amp goes out. And so I have to borrow an amp from a competing band. And I didn't tell them why or anything. Hey, you know, I need to borrow this. Can I borrow this for 2 days? Sure. No big deal. And, you know, everything was really competitive in the scene back in the day. People act like they're your friends. They're not your friends, especially when you succeed. So we go up there and we don't know anything about it, right? It's just a cold, dark rehearsal space. Nobody's there. We load our stuff in. It's freezing. We're trying to get our guitars acclimated. You know, this is before the technology that we would have now that could keep you in tune and stuff like that. Like, you know, this is just a bunch of idiots driving from Dayton, Ohio in a cold, 1994 van. So we pull up in there, we load in. Eventually, about 8 people come in. They do a very brief introduction. Hi, we're Victory Records. Play us what you have. There's nobody to give us any instruction or anything. We have no idea what to expect. We've never done it before. So we play our first song. And by the way, at this time we had 4 songs. So we're playing them all. That's all we could do.
Did any of these songs make it on the album?
They all did. That's all we had. So we played Nikki FM. We played a song called The Transition. We played Silver Bullet and a song called Wake Up Call. So those were the 4 songs that we had as Hawthorne Heights at the time. We obviously didn't tell them that, but we're playing these 4 songs because that's what we got.
That's all we got.
So we play our first song and, like, you know, it's pure adrenaline. So you're not thinking in your head, oh, we sounded awesome or we sounded terrible. There's no thought of that at all. You're thinking, am I in tune? Am I, you know, you're hanging on for dear life on a roller coaster. They do not clap or anything. Nothing. No response.
Wow.
And, you know, it's not like talking to a crowd or anything. So it's not like you're like, yo, so like we're from Dayton. You're just like,
you just got to be like, are you guys okay? It's like, is everything okay?
Yeah. With you? Are you surviving? And I will admit, it's extremely dark lit and they're standing all the way in the back. So they're not even like in front of us really. So they're all the way in the back, dark. It was like an interrogation. It was like, you know, like we're getting picked out of a lineup and we're hoping that they pick us. But, you know, so that process happens through all four of these songs. And then at the end, they don't say anything, but we put our guitars down. And I told the guys that I wanted to do this beforehand. I was like, at the end, I want to put everything down and I want to go up immediately and talk to them. And I want to meet them and I want to shake their hands and thank them for the opportunity. So that was my big thing, is I just wanted them to know that we appreciate being here. We handed them all, we brought t-shirts for them all. We brought our little demos, handed them directly to them, said, thank you so much. You know, it was our pleasure playing for you. And all they said back was, thank you. We'll let you know.
Wow.
That was it.
The amount of showcases that I've done that sound exactly like that they must all just sound be like that, all of them, just like terrified.
Maybe.
Like, don't know what the fuck to do. So I think, you know, when we talked about this album, what really was prevalent to me was that this album, there's no, at least to me, there is no other album that sounded more like this era of time than this album. Like that, it really shaped, at least for me and the people that I grew up with, what everything was all about. Like it felt like 2004. It's very difficult for me to like listen or hear another song or hear another album and be like, oh yeah, that was everything that was going on that year. It was this thing. It was this album. And I said it when we recorded. I was like, this was the album that like kids would put on their fucking in their rooms and their parents would come in and go like, ah, oh, fuck, dude. Like, this is what my kid is into. Like, oh, fuck. Like, this is like what this is that. And, you know, at the time. This didn't, there was nothing that sounded like this. And it was incredibly new and incredibly like, it was like contradictory to a lot of the albums and bands that we were listening to before. I mean, do you look back at this time, that time period with like, you know, there has to be like fondness, but like, I really don't like focusing on nostalgia, especially with like what we do, but it's really hard. But it's really, really hard for me to take a look at this Hawthorne Heights album without feeling everything like about 2004, like the smells, the places, the fucking mall, your parents be like wearing, actually being like, oh, okay, I am going to wear skinny. Like this was the album that like made the scene. Do you look back at that era being like, we're trying all this shit, this is new, we're scared, or you look back being like, we know what we're doing and we're going to move forward and like, I don't know how a band like you guys would come in that sounded so different than everything and move forward.
I think, and first of all, thank you for saying all that. It really warms my heart. And like living through moments in real time that have turned into nostalgia to me is one of the greatest gifts I've ever been given. And I think one of the reasons that it has happened is because we've always lived in that moment. We've always remained true to that moment. And we've never tried to be cooler than we think we are. And I think that is why a lot of kids connected early on is because we were willing to rent out our own hall just to play for people, just to make ourselves feel better and to make them feel better. Like, that has always been our thing. So I think authenticity has always been on our side. And for every bit of authenticity we have, we also are peeling back the curtain. So you're seeing that we're humans. We're like, we've always been like a very humanized band, whereas some bands, they're kind of the polar opposite of that. And they're like larger than life. And that's also totally cool and incredible in its own right. So I think that we didn't put up this facade that nobody could get through. I think we were very palatable for people. And I kind of make the joke that we were like hardcore with training wheels. So we were people's like introductory, because I'm right there with you guys. I know what you guys were listening to at that time period before all of this started to really become kind of a movement. And it was all Sum 41, Blink 182, Good Charlotte. And then, you can peel back further to less mainstream bands, but it was all rooted in fun and pop punk and stuff like that. And like what we were doing was more rooted in the heartache of, because we grew up with like Sunny Day Real Estate and stuff like that also at the same time, and Blink 182, and the straight edge hardcore movement of like Earth Crisis or like mm-hmm. bands like Snapcase and like mm-hmm. stuff like that. So like we really were an amalgamation of a lot of different things that should not have worked together. And I think that's why it did. And I think that at that time period, before you got into like a whole lot of screaming, because, like we would do a tour and we were open for anything. So like we would do a tour with bands totally in our scene. And then we would hop on a tour with Mest or mm-hmm. Sum 41, like a very mainstream Hot Topic version of what was happening as well. So it kind of made us open to everybody. We sounded like a heavy band on those tours, but then we also sounded like the melodic band on a tour with like Silverstein and Alexis on Fire and stuff like that. So it all kind of worked. And I think that that's where our place is. We're a very, sometimes you think the term like in between or the term middle of the road seems negative. I think in this case, at that time in the scene, it was a positive for us. We were the middle of the United States. We weren't too heavy. We weren't too happy. We were kind of right in there. But I think it was accessible to sad people and accessible to happy people. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is kind of the vibe. So I think that's the beauty of it, though, is like, I grew up a kid who had divorced parents. I grew up in a trailer court in West Virginia. So I've never known any sort of luxury or extravagance. It's always put your head down and work as hard as you can and love as hard as you can. So I think that's kind of where our whole vibe has always been. And I think that like, you guys remember what it was like when everybody went from like, I don't know, no one knowing who they were to like showing up to 400 kids in like the weirdest rental hall you've ever seen, but the bands are like wearing Diesel jeans, but they clearly can't even afford hotel rooms.
Mm-hmm. Oh, like, dude, that was legitimately exactly what I went through.
Yeah, so it was like that. It was like, these little tiny fragments of time, we were all just trying to keep up, just like you kids were trying to keep up. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You guys were trying to like there was a part where none of this was cool and it was, you identified it because of that. And then there was a point where you were like, nah, that's my band. And now the cheerleaders got them, but still that's my band. Do you know what I mean? So like, that's
absolutely,
that to me is the beauteous part. The most beautiful part of 2004 is, I don't want to come off like it's so grandiose, but like when I was a kid, my movement was the grunge and the punk rock movement of 94. So when I first heard Green Day and Nirvana and the Smashing Pumpkins and all that stuff, you flash forward 10 years later, and that's kind of what we were doing inadvertently. Not because we were like, dude, this is going to be the next grunge. It just kind of played out like that. You know, like, and you can think of Hot Topic and MTV and Fuse and all of that stuff showing, you know, like, oh, we got to get a hold of this because something's bubbling in the underground. And that's because of you kids. That's because of you guys, like, being in your friend's basement and being on MySpace and stuff like that and just, like, spreading that. I 100% credit that movement from the fans because you guys, you're the first generation of people, and I hope you realize this, you're the first generation of people that actually had music discovery, and you were turning people onto it immediately.
No, dude, that I think you nailed it. And the thing is when I was growing up, I think that we might be very, very close to the same age because you mentioned a lot of like pretty much like the trajectory of like what I listened to and like what I liked and how I got into things. I always look back at that era being like, fuck, dude, they had the 60s with the Beatles, they had the 70s with like all the disc, like they had all of these like very defining genres, they had 90s with grunge. And I thought that like 2000s were nothing. I thought at that time, I was like, we don't have an identity. And the thing about it is looking back now, and that's why what I said before, and I even know that it wasn't very like a question, but it's hard to like convey the feeling of creating a scene when you think that there is none. And I always looked back at, you know, even until like 2000, like until we started this, till we started it in 2014, I was like, the 2000s didn't have an identity. And now I look back and be like, and I feel like that was the best era, you know. Yeah. And it's so strange to think about it when living in it, being like, dude, that this is nothing. And now I look back and be like, this absolutely shaped the course of culture, pop culture, and music for where we're at right now.
JT, 100%. I did have a more specific, like, technical question for you. We got the physical CD, the first pressing. Going through the album booklet, you guys didn't have a producer credit. But when I look online, I did see like Sean O'Keefe's name mentioned on like his Wikipedia.
This is a great story.
Okay, great. I'll just let you take it
from
here.
This is a great story.
Yeah, we wanted to get to the bottom of this.
Oh, you're going to get to it. This is great. And we can talk about it now because it's all part of the story. Before, it was like, I don't know, the wound was too fresh. Now it's like, it's just part of, you know, you have the levity of being an adult and just like being like, yeah, that's, you know, that happened. That's cool. Yeah. Whatever. At the time period. So we'll go back a tiny bit. We're at the rehearsal studio. We play the four songs, we leave, we drive back silently in the winter. We don't talk because we know that we had just fucked everything up. We don't leave and go, dudes, that felt really good. History will be made today. It was like, we didn't say a word. So, you know, we go home silently crying on the inside, just... It's like you just missed the free throw to lose the game. Mm-hmm. So, and it was unspoken. We never got negative with each other. We never said, dude, you sang like shit, or you played off time, or you were out of tune. None of that. It was internal that we were all just thinking that. But, you know, the next day was a Sunday, and we're like, we didn't talk to each other at all. Like literally at all. We didn't mention this to anybody, anything, but Monday morning rolls around. I'm not joking. At 9 a.m. we have a contract in our inbox, and like, we're on top of the world. We're in hell and on top of the world within 48 hours. But that's all part of the fun of this. So we only had four songs we negotiate the contract the best we can. You guys all know that story from that time period. You know, and we're like, all right, boys, everybody quit your job because now we got to write songs. We got 6 weeks until we're in the studio recording our debut album. So we spend that 6 weeks just busting our ass trying to become a real band. You know what I mean? We have four songs that we wrote that summer, and then we have to write the other seven. We have no Ohio's for Lovers. This is not even in the world yet. You know, nobody's even thinking about that at all. So we get to the studio for pre-production, and I'm entirely sick. Matt, our bass player, is also entirely sick. So we can't even really do the pre-production with like singing and showing the songs and everything. We don't have everything demoed out other than, you know, the first four. You know, I would say that we're probably 75% of the way there, but we really can't articulate it because we can't sing at all. And that goes on for about 4 or 5 days. So the producer, Sean, he really can't get a handle on us or anything. He has heard the songs. He likes the songs. Victory wanted us to use him because he had good luck with the Spitalfield record that we really, really liked was done there. Punchline Action was done there, and Fall Out Boy, Take This to Your Grave. So, you know, like he had, and Motion City soundtrack. So, you know, really good credits, really respectable guy and everything. Recorded some albums that we really liked at that exact moment in time that we looked up to. So we all felt good about it. But he couldn't get a handle on us because he doesn't know if we can play, if we can sing, if these songs are done. So you could see frustration for sure pretty early on. And like, we're hanging on for dear life. So, you know, we're all also like extremely positive and extremely frustrated at the same time. So I just think that during that whole process, like he didn't understand. First of all, like we talked about how screamo and emo really wasn't quite a thing yet. You know what I mean? So like we're screaming on, you know, you flash forward a little bit, we're screaming on some of these parts. And he's fighting us kind of every step of the way.
I mean, like, is he like, no, like, do not do that? Is he like,
yeah, why, do you not? You shouldn't really be screaming right there. And like, we also have a lot of like, Nikki FM is basically rooted in Iron Maiden. You know, they're three part harmonies and stuff. At that time period, we were a three guitar player band. So we were different than a lot of stuff that was happening. And so he had a lot of work to do to try to, in his eyes, wrangle it in. And meanwhile, we're like wild birds who can't be caged. So we're like, no, he's just going to scream that backup part because that's what our band does. You know, that's what we sound like. This is what we want to sound like. So I think that all of that just was a little too much for him. And like eventually he was like, I'm not putting my name on this. I cannot put my name on this. I do not believe that you guys are making good decisions. And at the time period, you know, like we're pissed. We're so mad, but you know, we're trying to get through it and everything. And then, you know, like we got the label coming down on us. Your producer's telling us you're not good enough, blah, blah, blah. He doesn't want to put his name on the record. And, you know, so your ego is not really prepared for that as your first thing. So we think we're fucking things up, but we're still holding strong with this is what our band sounds like. We believe in this. We're going to scream here. We're going to shred here. And we're going to be clean here. That's just what we sound like. You know, get over it, is basically what we said. So I think that he had a really hard time with that because he was trying to produce us. You know, we were taking some of the stuff that he said to heart. It wasn't like all negative or anything like that. I just think that like we probably weren't quite prepared to be in the studio at that moment. We probably maybe needed another 2 weeks or something like that to really make our first record. But that's why I listened back to it. I'm like, I know exactly why that part sounds like that, because we were fucking it up, or we weren't accepting advice. So it sounds weird and random, but that's what's awesome about it. That's why it's different. That's why it sets it apart. And like, I couldn't tell you which part of Ohio is for Lovers is the chorus. Is it the I can't make it on my own? Is it the, you know, you do, you kill me well? I don't know, and I don't care. Do you know what I mean? But when you have somebody in there like going, you know, what are you doing here?
Which is the part that I need to fucking focus on?
Yeah. Exactly. So like, I think that we were the most complicated thing that he had done at the time. And we weren't particularly willing to be kind of pushed around and like stripped away and stuff like that. But I wouldn't change that at all. You know what I mean? Like the funny thing is he tried to sue us later on, for royalties, but that's not on us. You got to sue the band and the label. You know what I mean? But it was like, so you didn't want your name on the record, but you want to get paid for the record? It's always a little bit of a rub to me. It's not
now that it's
my
successful
territory.
Chorus.
Yeah. And you know, like I get it and everything. He did. He worked hard on the record and everything like that. And it wasn't our choice or anything like that. But like, so yeah, I think it was just a little bit contentious. I have no hard feelings towards Sean whatsoever. Talented guy, was a talented guy at the time period as well. I just think it was a challenging project because you got this new band who is writing these new songs in this new scene. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So like you flash forward 3 years and you're like, okay, these guys, they want to sound like The Used and Story of the Year or whatever it was. You know what I mean? Like, I get it. You know, like there's screaming, there's singing. I get it. So like that was definitely like a heartbreaking, ego breaking, but also exhilarating at the same time. Yeah. Like, no, we all stuck together and we didn't let anybody steamroll us on our sound.
And you were right. You were right.
I think that we were. I think that that's what makes Hawthorne Heights a little bit different, though. When you hear the sounds in Black and White and hear those weird harmonies and weird parts screaming and weird times and stuff like that, like we didn't allow that challenge to hinder us in any way. And also, like, there is a lot of angst on that record because of it, because we are pissed during these sessions. You know what I mean? We're more excited than we could ever be in our lives. We're recording in the same studio that parts of Nevermind were recorded in, and Siamese Dream and stuff like that. And we see the plaques on the wall. It's incredible. I'm using a microphone that Kurt Cobain used. So like we are wide eyed and like just we are trying to make a difference. And but then you also have the chaos that's going on behind the scenes. And then you have the label chaos because they have to like stand up for the producer a little bit and be like, hey, we're getting yelled at by the producer. What's going on in there? Do you guys suck? And you know, like three albums in, you're like, oh, chaos is, this is just what happens. But at that time period, we're like, oh my God, you know?
Yeah.
And hey, how old were you when this was recording? Like when this recorded?
We would have all been like early to mid 20s.
Yeah. So you're like early 20s, like not like being in the early 20s, trying to figure it out, having four songs going into a studio where you're like starstruck about the fucking microphones, dude. We lived a very, very, very same trajectory thing. I know all of the things that you're talking about. And, you know, it really does. There were so many great bands where I grew up that had the opportunity to play in front of a label and never made it. And, you know, it is really, it's very, very cool to see you here this many years later being the band that made it. You know, like it is, do you feel like at the time you're like, fuck, I won the lottery, or you're just like, I still feel like that. Yeah. Like that is, cause that's what that to me, I know that feeling about, you know, I got so many like, and still all the time, we still get like, no, we don't want you to do this. No, we don't want you to do this. And when we, you know, at that time, when you're like a little kid being like, yeah, we want you to do this. This is big time shit. You don't know anything. Like you were talking about being in the fucking Midwest. You're like, I've never been to Chicago. Like how the fuck are you supposed to navigate being in a studio with a producer that like knows everything and thinks, you know, and you have to listen to that, like listen to them because they did the things that you like, but you're like, no, this is what I believe in. I think that you did. Like, to me, it feels like you very much, you know, won the lottery here. And that's a really inspiring and cool thing to like be, well, you know, it's awesome, dude. It really is fucking sick.
But at the same time, I think like you guys still are an exemplar of like an extremely hardworking band, you know, like,
oh yeah, not saying that you're not
the festivals that you, that you're currently putting on. It's not just you got lucky, like you guys worked very hard and you're still like one of the most hardworking bands in the scene.
Every time we record shit, I'm like, fuck, I wish I would have said that. Or I wish I would have like done this different. I wish I would have told this story. Is there like one thing that you're like, oh, you guys need to know this. The people that like love Hawthorne Heights need to know this, that like, there's not, we can't look up, we can't see on socials. There's no article about like, you know, is there that one thing that's what I really like want to get out of these and like convey the, like what it was like being alive and in that, in this time.
Yeah. I think the most important thing about understanding Hawthorne Heights and Hawthorne Heights' trajectory is really that we had no idea what we were doing at all. And that's always been the beauty of it. And like, we, as, like while kids were looking up to us and like what we were wearing and stuff like that, we had no idea what we should be wearing. We had nobody to tell us what to be wearing. So we were looking at them as much as they were looking at us. And that's how transparent our relationship has always been with our fans. But you know, there's like, we would take every single tour that we could, and we were willing to take risks and play with bands that we had no business playing with, because that's what you should be doing. So like, now everything feels like really linear and feels like, oh, well, we can't headline over them, or we can't co-headline with that band. Like, we've never cared about any of that stuff. Like, that's not why you should be doing this. You should be doing it because you wanted to be in that van, and in 20 years later you want to be in that van. So the most important thing is we still don't have any idea what we're doing. We're just so excited to be doing it and to be playing that, like, you know, coming from nothing, wanting nothing other than to be accepted. I think that's basically everything that we've tried to do. I had never told that Sean O'Keefe story though. So that is a good one for you guys. That's a nugget. Also, we haven't really done a podcast like this yet, and our 20-year anniversary is this year, and we're doing a lot of stuff. So you guys are getting the first kind of look to peel back everything. And I love that, because, you know, you guys, you're awesome. I love talking to you guys. I love that 10 years later, in 2014, you guys got started. And the reason that I love it so much is because it's all rooted in music and the history. And I consider all of this just being like careful stewards and historians of a genre that we all grew up in our time period. That's why I love it. I know that there's a little bit of chaos that comes in all of this stuff, and that's exactly what we should be doing. Because if we all don't keep track of our memories and champion them every single day, who's going to? Nobody wants to just be a blurry picture, you know, from yesteryear.
And it's getting, you guys are keeping harder,
this relevant.
Dude.
It is. But you guys are
even tracking down relevant. Some of these physical CDs now is close to impossible. Like, finding that first pressing of that CD, and like, you know, you find what you can on the Spotify credits, you look up like discogs.com, but like, nowhere online did I find the thank you notes that you guys wrote when you were putting this record out. You know, like, that stuff can very easily get lost. And I think that's kind of like what we're trying to preserve with this podcast and dive into a little bit. So
and
thanks,
I
man.
Love
I appreciate
that.
Those words.
Yeah, yeah. And dude, I just wanted to say thanks for taking a look back at this album and this year in particular. I truly believe that, you know, regardless of where this album lays in people's favorite albums of all time, I believe that this album changed the trajectory of music and the scene forever. I really do believe that with all my heart. So thank you for
that. Means so much.
Being incredibly honest and being incredibly yourself, and your band. I think it's inspiring, especially to younger artists now that want to start, to be like, all right, if what we've heard over and time before, just be yourself, be fucking true to you.
Yeah.
Stop listening to everybody else. Do what you think is tight, and this what will happen.
And in a world of Instagram reels and TikTok and stuff like that, that stuff is all 100% necessary, but you have a vehicle to be authentic within those platforms. And I think that these kids, these new bands can be doing the exact same thing that we were doing face to face in DIY rental halls, playing by any means necessary. You have to understand that you yourself and your personality is the star of the show, and you have to be able to connect in any way possible. So, don't just do stuff for the wrong reasons. Try to write a song that you think is going to change your life, and it'll change somebody else's life. That really is that's the only mantra that we've ever lived by. And, sometimes we wore bad pants, sometimes we wore awesome pants, and that's just gonna be how it is. And but yeah, man, I'm starting just now to I got 12 gigs of photos from that time period, from the sessions, from the first tour,
wow,
from the first Warped Tour, and I'm combing through it, and it's like looking at the best yearbook you've ever seen. Even just a picture of us playing live, you look out and you see the fans, what they're wearing and everything, and you're just like, oh my God, white belt. Yeah. They are wearing the white belt. It's become a costume, but now it's incredible.
No, you go to shows now and they are not wearing it unironically. Legitimately, yeah, has come back around. And that's what I'm saying. I truly believe that you guys changed the trajectory of what this entire scene was in a lot of ways that I don't think that we will even recognize until we're another 20 years down the line. So, this podcast run, I'd love to just do it again. I'd just love to be on it and bullshit and not even ask any, just talk about this, because you are you're great. And I love everything that you have to say, and it means a lot to us. So,
yeah, thank you very much, man. I think one of the reasons that we've always gotten along ever since the first time we ever met you guys was just kindred spirits, doing things for the right reasons, and really just for the love of all of this, despite any sort of monetization of the world. We all literally love this stuff, and we're happy to be there, talk about it, hang out with it, and look out and see the fans, just seeing you guys a couple weeks ago and being there and everything, you can just see the culture that is being preserved, and how you see a 21-year-old at Emo Night LA and you're like, that person should not care about these songs. Do you know what I mean? They're 100% fully invested. And that's incredible to see. And that is what it takes. You know what I mean? It takes somebody digging deep, and preserving everything that happened, starting with the albums that are quote unquote iconic, to digging back to everything that other people were listening to that didn't quite get its fair shake. Whatever that is, I say that, the Ecstatic Lullabies or the Halifax, stuff like that. There's so many great albums from that time period that something or other didn't quite work. You know, the band broke up a little bit early, and like, I want to see these kids get digging even deeper. You know, you start here. It's like when we started with, when I started with Dookie by Green Day and found No Effects, or found, you know what I mean? Like the mainstream kind of digs backwards. That's what you guys are doing. And that's what I think is awesome about it. Like, of course, like the heavy hitters are always going to have a seat at the table, but like everybody else, now you're seeing them like go back, well, who did you listen to? Or they'll see a tour flyer and they'll be like, whoa, let me check that band out. So like, I know that everybody kind of wants to be a naysayer when it comes to like streaming and stuff like that and Spotify, but like, think about that as like an encyclopedia of music, and like, not everybody can have it in a physical format anymore, but now you can listen to something that was just fractionally part of the scene in 2003 that was a pivotal landmark album that nobody would ever know was.
Yep.
And I think that's one of the reasons that we love it so much.
I mean I couldn't agree with you more, man. Like, the, you know, you were talking about something earlier that really reminded me of like when we first started and everybody was like, this is not cool, you know, why are you guys doing this? This is not cool. And when you guys were starting it, everybody was like, this is not, what are you guys doing? This is not cool.
Don't,
like,
do that. Stop playing like that. Like, yeah. What are you doing? Why are you playing those songs?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So 100%.
Yeah.
We're happy to prove people wrong though, aren't we? And that is absolutely the best thing about all this, is we've all just been disruptors that people have totally said, this shit is not cool. And then they'll be the first to have their hand out when it is.
And then they're like, can I get a guest list?
100%. Can I get a guest list of that thing that I told you was not, you should not be doing?
Yeah.
100%. But it's awesome to.
It is what it is, man. Like, you know, I'm just happy. Look, this is all extra. I'm just happy to be here.
100%. We're all living a bonus life right now.
Yeah.
That's the best part about it. I love that.
Thank you so much, JT. It's been an awesome 50 minutes. We really appreciate you getting on with us. This was a great podcast, and we'll see you soon, I'm sure. I think we have you booked for a bunch of emo nights coming up pretty soon. So I'm sure we'll see you around, and thanks again.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. Always great to be at your parties.
Thanks,
love the vibe, everything about it. Of course,
you're the fucking man. This was awesome.
I'll see you guys soon. We'll see you all summer.